Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Yeah, we're going to have a Solartopia. This is Harvey Wasserman, the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show, on today for another great, great hour talking about hemp. We have Doug Fine with us. Doug, you with us?
I'm with you, Harvey. How's it going?
Wonderful, wonderful. So last 2 weeks ago, we talked about marijuana and your fabulous book, Too High to Fail. And we're going to jump in today and talk about more about hemp. We got a full hour to do it. We're at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888 if anybody wants to call in. Before we get into this, though, Doug, I want to talk a bit about the latest news from Fukushima. Pretty terrifying, actually. We have reports now that they have lost power at the Fukushima nuclear site. Now, people might think, well, what difference does it make? The place blew up anyway. It's a smoldering ruin. What do you need power for? Well, the reality is that there are at least four spent fuel pools there that actually probably six, given the other two reactors that weren't allegedly weren't affected by the disaster. But we have four spent fuel pools there that are in serious trouble, including one that's 100 feet in the air and could lose water at any time. And if the electricity is failing at the site, then we're not going to have power to keep these spent fuel pools cool. Now, this is everybody's worst nightmare, because these the fuel rods in these pools could, in fact, go into fission and release more radiation than has ever been conceived of by any nuclear power plant. And this is the ultimate nightmare here. We are standing by on this. I've gotten a number of confirmations on the email and have posted a piece at nukefree.org, N-U-K-E-F-R-E-E.org, about the ongoing situation at Fukushima. Now, last week, we reported, and we'll be talking about this next week, actually, with Joe Mangano and a number of others, that a definitive study has come in from Fukushima, done by the prefecture, which is, I guess, the equivalent in our terms of a state, looking at the thyroids of children in the area, and with a very, very large sample. My understanding is they've studied about almost 400,000 people in the area, and this would be including almost 100,000 children. And they've done 10 studies. They've done successive studies at Fukushima on the thyroids of small children. Now, you would expect, I mean, it's a given, really, that given the nature of what's happened there, you would have an epidemic of thyroid problems because of the spread of iodine-131, which is radioactive, and it goes straight to the thyroid. It's a beta emitter, and it will, if it goes into your thyroid, which is where it'll go first, it will emit electrons, which will destroy some or all of the tissues, living tissues in your thyroid. Now, what's happened at Fukushima clearly is that the iodine-131, blanketed the area around the plant. And when you have small children, even the fetus in utero that's exposed to iodine-131, it will go straight to the thyroid, and developing child, a developing organism, the amount of damage that can be done by a tiny amount of radioactive iodine to a developing thyroid can be catastrophic. The last thing you want to do to a developing child is to harm their thyroid, because it affects all developmental realities, including mental and both mental and physical development. And so the report from Fukushima Prefecture is that we have a 44% indication of thyroid damage among the children in the Fukushima area from a sample of about 95,000 children. I mean, this is staggering. And earlier, this was the 10th study, as I mentioned, and earlier studies indicate a lower rate. So what's happening clearly is that the rate of thyroid damage to children around Fukushima is accelerating, which is exactly what we would expect, because it takes it does take some time for the radiation to do harm. Iodine-131 has a short half-life, 8 days. We don't know if I-131 is continuing to be emitted there. I would not believe any disclaimer by the company saying that no, there's no I-131 being currently emitted. But even with the massive doses that came out 2 years ago, we would expect a rising rate of thyroid damage to show up in these studies. So that's the very bad news. We're going to go into that in some detail next week. Hopefully we'll be able to report that power was restored at Fukushima and that these spent fuel pools did not ignite, which they very easily could do if they're not kept cool. So we will try and keep cool in the meantime. And with that happy note, I want to welcome Doug Fine to our show. Doug, you're with us today.
Yeah, yeah. So let me bring everyone back up, because for all the danger and troubles in the world, the plan we're going to be talking about today, really all the rumors are true. I just have been researching it for 3 months for a book for TED, the people that put on the TED Talk. And we're going to be talking about good news today.
Okay, so are you going to be talking on TED? Are you going to get a TED Hour?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Well, good for you. Fantastic.
Yeah.
All right, so tell us now, revisit a little bit your book. Tell us what your book is about, because I wouldn't do it justice, although we had a ton of fun the last time we talked, which is why I invited you back. Tell us about your book and how you got into this marijuana situation here. Tell us, we can talk first about marijuana again, and then we'll go deep into this, to the issues of hemp.
So now I call all versions of the plant cannabis, and the big book that I researched for a year in the Emerald Triangle in Northern California that came out and we discussed last week is about psychoactive, social, spiritual, medicinal cannabis, and that's called Too High to Fail. And I got into that because we all know the drug war is wrong, 80% of Americans know. But I had crazy scenes where I live on the border of New Mexico, crazy scenes of how the drug war was being fought. That's all covered in the book, that inspired me to find an alternative instead of just whining about the drug war. And I found it in Mendocino County, California, where the local government permitted successfully the number one multi-million-dollar crop. And that's what we discussed last week, and that's what Too High to Fail is about.
Well, and not multi-million, multi-billion.
Multi-billion with a B, yeah.
You said the size of the industry, the gross volume, dollar volume done on cannabis in Mendocino County alone is $6 billion a year. Was that correct?
That's right. And the number one currently federally legal crop is grapes at $74 million. So if you're a young farmer with a green thumb, which would you choose? Now, as big as that is and what that represents, I just now have finished. I'm just doing final revisions here for this multimedia TED ebook about the industrial side of cannabis, commonly referred to as hemp, which humans have been using for 8,000 years. And guess what? I think it's going to be even bigger. That's from 3 months research in the field. I had to do fun things like research on soil remediation via hemp in Hawaii, and on paper less fun, heading up to Canada in February, the Canadian prairies, and seeing everything that's happening on the industrial and agricultural side of the $500 million that America already buys in Canadian hemp every year. We're the world's biggest hemp market, which isn't surprising. We're the world's biggest everything market. It's illegal to grow in our own country. We have to sort of be servants, economic servants to the rest of the world on this for now.
Well, let's step back for a moment, and since you said, matter-of-factly, as people do, said a staggeringly insane, given us a staggeringly insane fact, hemp is illegal to grow in the United States of America. Can you explain how this is and how this happened? I mean, you know, and I know, and actually there's a quote in the front of your book from Tom Jefferson here. Let me read it real quickly. It is vastly desirable to be getting underway with our domestic cultivation and manufacture of hemp, flax, cotton, and wool. Now, having studied Tom Jefferson and George Washington in some detail, you and I both know that Washington and Jefferson both loved hemp. Washington imported special seeds from India. There's a passage in Jefferson's agricultural diary where he talks about what a pain in the ass tobacco is to grow, but how much he loves growing hemp. Tell us a bit about those two guys and their hemp crops to begin with.
Yeah, sure. Well, there's no question that even in colonial times it was an important crop to grow. I mean, we could give example after example. One of the famous ones is that Thomas Jefferson wrote the draft of the Declaration of Independence on hemp. That's what everybody used.
But then he smoked it and wrote a better one.
Right, that was just the first draft. But what really blew me away now in the research of this new book is how far ahead the rest of the world is on this already. Hemp provides great building insulation, sort of market-ready, a way lower energy to put into the production than pink fiberglass insulation, basically better, make results in better houses, has real potential as an energy source already.
Wait. Before you jump away from that, I've never actually heard that. Are you saying that hemp can substitute for fiberglass insulation on a house?
All over Europe, it's already happening. Canada's in on it already. Yeah, it's for those who know about building materials, it's got an R factor of 20 on 12 inches or 30 on, I think it's 16 inches, possibly 18 inches. So very competitive, easy to work with. The hemp book I'm writing now not only has descriptions of hemp houses that I visited, but scientific research being going on at universities about how it holds up, how it performs thermodynamically. Builders raving about how easy it is to build with. The only thing that's keeping it from being cost competitive in the U.S., in other words, the only reason that it's not at Home Depot right now next to pink insulation is that we have to import the actual hemp fibers. That's the other nice thing about it, is it uses otherwise unusable parts of the plant. It uses the kind of woody herd plant that can't be used for food or high-end fiber like clothing.
Well, so if God forbid your house burns down, the firemen all get stoned. All right, that's a bad joke. So tell me, though, the hemp, I mean, I've worked, I'm sure everybody listening has worked one time or another with insulation. The fiberglass insulation is really bad stuff. I mean, it gets in your lungs, gets on your hands, you got to wear gloves. So are there any side effects to handling hemp as a building material and as an insulation agent?
Only positive ones. It sequesters carbon because the method for making the insulation material, and we're just talking about one building application. Hemp has other building applications too. So
yeah, we'll get to those because I know hemp. I've read actually where hemp is as strong as steel. But let's do the insulation here first. Tell us about insulating a house with hemp.
Yep, and again, readers, I mean listeners, will want to know that this book that I'm just finishing is probably going to come out in May, and so you'll be able to hear a lot more about this.
And what's the title going to be?
I have it as tentatively as King Seed, because that's the Persian name for it. Shah Duman is, in 4,000 years, the Persians have called it the King of Seed. And but I'm working with 10 people right now on revision, so it's possible that the title could change, but just folks, keep posted at DougFine.com, follow on Twitter, et cetera, where you can link to from my website. You'll know all about when that one's coming out, and I have tons of video that's associated with it. It's a really fun project. But so back to the insulation side, it's basically it's hemp herd, kind of like woody fibers that look like the kind of stuff you throw in your guinea pig's cage kind of thing, mixed with lime to totally replace cement and pink fiberglass on the insulation process. And it makes this light, fluffy kind of fill that has a lot of air in it, traps air, that's really good for insulation. I didn't know this. This is all from research on site at building sites over the past few months. And so the lime actually wants carbon to harden back into a solid form. So it traps carbon and actually reduces it. Basically, is the house itself, as one builder puts it, is an air filter.
Wow. Now, does it require paper backing like fiberglass?
No, but here we're not talking about load support and structural support. We're just talking about insulation.
Right. Now, do you pour it into the gap between the wall and the outside siding?
Yep, there's two ways to do it. You can just hand tamp it into forms as you walk around the house, do it in different levels. It cures very quickly. Or you can kind of shoot it out of a foam kind of gun if you're a little bit higher budget and fill it in. But it's all around a fairly fast way to do it, even if you do it with hand tamping.
So now I'm assuming that if hemp were legal, it would be cheaper than fiberglass.
Yeah, I mean, the way that the British are doing this, big all over Europe and Canada, they're already doing it. But the British are in the lead, and I spoke to sort of the vice president of the company that's done hundreds of houses, including government-funded development. And Marks and Spencer, the big shot department store in Britain's most recent department store, the hemp department store. So I spoke to him, and the way he described it is now, with hemp totally, totally legal, basically, in Europe. Let's keep it at that for now. The way that he described it is, it's a no-brainer if you're the person that's going to be maintaining the structure, be it a building or a home house. If you're just a contractor looking to get it done and flip it right now, and you're just doing the European version of Home Depot petroleum junk, arguably, it's a slightly harder sell, because it can be slightly more, just from a material standpoint, slightly more expensive at this point. And we're not talking about a huge scale yet either, even in Europe. It's already close. But he said once you're thinking more than a year ahead, it's a no-brainer in terms of lifetime energy cost, health of the environment, ease of building, all that jazz.
So actually now, of course, if you're looking at the deep conspiratorial side, you would say that the fiberglass insulation industry has a major economic stake in keeping hemp illegal.
Yeah, the drug war has gone on for a really long time, 40 years, $1 trillion taxpayer dollars, and there's plenty of entrenched interests that don't want it to change. But I'm not worried about the entrenched interests anymore, because the Republicans are leading the charge in Kentucky to get the historic hemp industry going again. They're especially excited about it for energy use. In Hawaii, it's a Republican legislator that's pushing it. The nonsense conspiracy arguments they're being laughed at, basically, by everyone. So I'm not that worried about it.
Well, I'm glad you're not. That's good to hear. I mean, if Rand Paul can filibuster against Barack Obama's drone attacks, then the Republicans can get behind industrial hemp. So we're glad to hear that. Okay, let's move on from insulation. And this could happen overnight, right? I mean, it wouldn't take them, it'd take all of one season to convert many, 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 many millions of acres from traditional crappy crops to a good old-fashioned American hemp, right?
Oh, yeah. I interviewed for this new book the North Dakota's agricultural commissioner, not, shall we say, a liberal. And he's ready, man. He's ready. He knows the farmers.
Was he packing when you interviewed him?
That one was a phone interview.
What's that?
Yeah, that one was a phone interview, but he was a really nice guy.
Oh, all right. Okay. So tell me, what did the North Dakota Agricultural Commissioner say about planting next year's hemp crop?
Well, North Dakota's actually had a battle going on for a long time. It's been on the books legal to grow in North Dakota for a very, very long time. And North Dakota has sued the Drug Enforcement Administration to issue a permit. Because it's a little bit different, actually, with hemp when you look at federal law, how federal law has been administered vis-a-vis the Controlled Substance Act and how it relates to the International Convention on Narcotics from 1961. And basically, how it comes down to in the U.S. is, no, it's not like a federal crime like psychoactive cannabis is. You just need to make sure that you get a DEA permit to do it. Guess how many times that's happened in the last 75 years?
One.
Well, it's happened a couple of times post-World War II. The real truth came out, of course, in 1942. Anyone who's got YouTube access, click on hemp for Victory. It's a government propaganda film from 1942, speaking the truth about hemp, sounding like your tie-dyed roommate about how long hemp has been in the service of humankind, begging people to grow it for the war effort because the Japanese took over the Philippines and the Navy didn't have access.
Yeah, I've seen that video. You have some really tall, skinny hemp plants there, man.
Yeah, that's how you do it, especially if you want fiber.
They're really looking for the stalk, aren't they, when they grow industrial hemp?
It depends on what your application is. The biggest application in North America right now is food. And for that, you want seeds for oil.
Food, really?
Yeah, that's the whole market in the U.S. pretty much. And our hemp granola, our hemp oil that I put in my shake every morning, that's what Canada grows. They grow these short varieties that have tons and tons of seeds on them, and they don't even deal with the fiber. And that's starting to change as the market grows, because their market's growing at like 30% a year, all from us buying it all, the U.S. So they're starting to think about fiber, but one of the things I wrote about in the book is you really should be thinking about both with your crop. That's kind of like one of the big theses of the new hemp book. So.
All right, so let's move from insulation to building material, actual building material. Now, what can you do with hemp to build houses and other structures?
One of the interesting applications I saw on the building side was there's a government and industry partnership in Canada. Excuse me, hold on. My headset for a second. So there's a place in Canada where there's a lot of hemp research going on that I visited and reported on extensively in this book. And what really was a telling thing, these guys can work on any fibers they want. And what the scientists at this innovation center have done is built a hemp load-bearing wall, basically a replacement for whatever solid load-bearing part of your house pulled the thing up. They built that in their own space out of hemp blocks because it's such a good sound insulator that that's where they put their compressors when they're doing, you know, loud, you know, if anybody's worked with air compressors, you know how loud they are. So they hide their machinery back there. And so it's really good soundproofing. They found it very, very easy to build with. It's an insulator and a load-bearing component. And shifting quickly to other industrial uses, in case listeners are thinking, oh, that sounds so nice, how quaint, how lovely, one day maybe when hemp. Well, guess what? Today, we're talking about hemp fibers, tensile strength being greater than steel. Today, BMW, Mercedes, Dodge, just to name a few, use hemp fibers in their door paneling material. It's that good. It's already probably in your car, depending on what you drive.
Interesting. Fantastic. So what else can you tell us now? Let's move ahead here with you said before that you thought that hemp could be financially bigger than marijuana. What makes you say that?
All right, here's why. So Budweiser is big, but ExxonMobil is bigger. And if we put our small farmers back
to work.
You're
comparing oil to beer?
In terms of how big an industry it is.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, so the buds of Budweiser don't compare to the megawatts of Exxon.
Right. So how is that going to apply? Well, first of all, besides all the residual industries of putting million farmers back to work on, as you described, millions of waiting acres in the North Dakotas and the Nebraskas, Colorado farmers are ready to go. Hawaii has a lot of applications for it, including soil remediation from sugarcane monoculture.
Okay, now let's not go too far here. Since we got some time, tell me about soil remediation. What are you talking about when you say hemp is going to do soil remediation?
Hemp has foot-long tap roots. So we have a big problem with desertification, right? We have erosion from a century and a half of monoculture, overgrazing, things like that. What hemp does is it's a soil fixer. It has foot-long tap roots that can grow on what's known as marginal land, toxified land. And while stabilizing the soil to help other nutrients come back in, and reestablish themselves, and other crops thus be able to come in a rotation and reestablish themselves. It also has certain detoxifying effects on the soil as well. So in other words, it can help clean up the soil.
How does hemp clean up the soil from toxic chemicals?
Hemp is not the only plant in the world that does this. There's
right.
a lot of others. Hatropha does this as well. It's just the nature
of... What
was
the plant name, sorry?
Hatropha. It's spelled with a J. J-A-T-R-O-P-H-A.
Oh, okay. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
I mean, you could argue that clover and any of the nitrogen fixers do the same as well. But basically what we're talking about is, for whatever reason, they, in processing the soil for their own, in their own nutrient exchange with it, can actually act basically like, you know, bounty quicker picker-upper absorbers of toxic elements, heavy metals, et cetera, things like that in the soil. So in Kentucky, there's an explicit plan to start planting it on coal-ravaged soil from surface mining, and put local farmers back to work there. They don't have their tobacco crop anymore. They don't have their coal jobs anymore. Put them back to work growing hemp to remediate the soil and then put it into energy plants. So that's the part I'm really excited about. So we were talking about ExxonMobil, right?
So wait, one quick thing here. Now, when you talk about this, does the hemp transform the chemicals, or does it just pull the chemicals out into the body of the plant?
That's a really good question, and I actually haven't really looked at it into that scientific. You know, I was covering so many broad
areas. That's all right. By the time you get your book done, maybe you'll know that, and we can talk.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, really.
Because I've always wondered about this. So, well, these plants clean up the soil. Do they? I mean, arsenic is still arsenic. So, do they clean up the soil by pulling the arsenic out and incorporating it into the body of the plant? In which case, mm-hmm. all they've done is move it. Or do they chemically transform the arsenic into something else? That'd be good to know.
Definitely.
Anyway, go ahead, please.
I'll look in that. No, it's a great question. Thank you for that, Harvey. So moving on to energy.
Yeah. All right, so we're talking now. You said now that plant hemp can remediate marginal soil. I'm assuming hemp does not need a whole lot of water. And so
That's
it
right.
can be grown on – one of the reasons it can be grown on marginal soil is because it doesn't need to be watered. Is that correct?
That is correct. It requires very, very little water, certain varieties of it, that is. And it also, basically, like if you go to the Canadian government websites where they're advising hemp farmers, instead of arresting them, they're helping them.
Yeah.
Under the official provincial charts of various provinces in Canada, under pesticides, herbicides, fungicides needed, it's just none. So it's lower in water compared to, say, cotton when you're getting into textiles, which uses up to 30% of the world's pesticides and one of the most water-demanding plants, causing farmers all over the world to commit suicide because the crops are failing, climate change, et cetera, et cetera. Pesticide use making people sick. Hemp doesn't have those needs either.
Are you saying that there are no natural pest infestations that harm hemp?
I wouldn't say none, but few enough that you can find a variety just about anywhere that you can be successful with. On top of that, it actually acts as kind of a gate to keep other invasive plants from coming in. If you're rotating it with, let's say, a cereal crop or another seed crop, like some sort of seed oil or a cereal crop like wheat or something, it acts as its own invasive herbicide against other plants.
Well, no, is it a pest repellent? Does hemp repel pests?
Yeah. Other plants are like do that too. Like neem is another one that does that. Neem.
Yeah. Tree. Well, tansy also. You grow tansy around a fruit trees. But I know that because I lived on a hippie farm for 14 years. So, so this is fascinating. So you're saying, we used to. Back in the day, when hippies, I'll put it in the abstract, raised corn, they would raise the marijuana in the corn so that the corn would hide the marijuana. But you're saying also that it might well have been a natural pest repellent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, humans have used it that way for thousands of years, absolutely.
Well, very interesting. Okay,
so
never heard of that.
The way it manifests with energy, or the way that it looks likely to and is starting to be a little bit in Europe, is when you're done with, let's say, your seed application or your high-quality fiber application, you're left with what's called the woody herd or the shiv, okay?
Herd is what, H-U-R-D?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
like,
you can,
like curd for milk products. Okay, go ahead.
The most promising application that I think is, at least on the short-term horizon, I'm kind of, things change so much today these days that I always, in my last couple of projects, I'm always talking about what looks like likely to come first, what's ready, what's doable, what makes sense. There may be other applications, let's say driving on certain types of seed oil for biofuels, but the first one that looks really ready for prime time is you take that herd, that shiv, that otherwise unusable husk of the plant, basically, bale it up and use it in locally based regional power plants in a process called gasification. And it's already happening in Europe. There are plans to do it in Kentucky. Low emissions, almost no carbon emission. And it's not, hemp is not necessarily the most per acre efficient for gasification. But if you just have it anyway for a profitable seed oil and a profitable, let's say, clothing textile, a long fiber, and it's just sitting there, the Canadians have been burning it in the field. Instead of that, use it for regional energy, and I postulate in my forthcoming hemp book that it's going to be a way to put petroleum out of business, basically.
All right, so let's describe the process. Are you saying that you're taking this part of the hemp plant and burning it, or do you ferment it? How do you turn it into a usable feedstock for energy?
Well, when you mention fermentation, that's a third process. There's ethanol is another process, and that too is happening in other parts of the world. And what I do like about that is that there's no combustion going on at all. But evidently, not a engineer, but what's happening from all my research, tons and tons of research, gasification is a different thing. It's not like incineration. It's not like you're just creating a fire with smokestacks. It's this multi-chambered, I've got it all described and visualized in the book. It's this multi-boiler chamber thing where extremely high heat is happening, and the combustion is so quick and so intense that you're producing this pure energy that has almost no carbon emissions.
Well, that's pretty amazing. I assume that they deal with the off gas somehow.
Yes, I mean, I guess they do, because the Europeans have pretty strict environmental standards and they're pretty bullish on this stuff.
Okay, so we'll expect a good diagram in your forthcoming book.
That's right.
That was the great, and not to go too far afield, but since we are talking about hemp, with Doug Fine here, author of Too High to Fail, and of an upcoming book on hemp, industrial hemp, one of the great pioneers in America in industrial hemp, on the product side, I guess you'd call it, is Ben Franklin. Franklin's first printing press ran on hemp paper. And relevant to this discussion here of using hemp for a fuel, Franklin, invented the Franklin stove, which probably saved more global warming gases than any other single invention in the history of the human race, because everybody was burning, wood in open fires and in fireplaces. And what Franklin did was he put the fire inside a metal box, which made it way more efficient, cut down on the emissions, reburned a lot of the stuff, and contained these fires in a very, very important way, which saved billions of tons of fuel and trees and all that stuff. So I'm assuming that you're saying that the herds of the cannabis plant would be burned in a similar, probably reburning process.
That's right. It's a two-stage process. You got it exactly right, Harvey.
Okay, excellent. Ben Franklin's first stove was pretty complicated. They actually had to, the one that became way more popular was sort of trimmed down. In that case, he was too brilliant for his own good. For anybody who's interested, I'm reading an astonishing book, the great biography of Ben Franklin by Walter Isaacson, who also wrote the book on Steve Jobs. We're talking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, and about marijuana and an upcoming book about hemp. We're focusing on hemp now and will again when his book comes out. I actually just watched a documentary. His new book, Too High to Fail, is available from, I guess, is it Penguin here?
That's right. Yep, available
Gotham
everywhere.
Gotham Books is your hardcover, and I guess Penguin's the softcover. Is that correct?
No, Penguin is Gotham is an imprint of Penguin.
Oh, okay. Very good. So we're talking about industrial uses of hemp now. I mean, barely touched marijuana. I watched a documentary the other night about biofuels called Bio Willie. It was about, I guess, Willie Nelson made the movie.
Mm-hmm.
And all about how they're using 80-20 now, diesel fuel with 20% biofuel. They did not mention hemp at all. The thing was narrated by Woody Harrelson, and the word hemp did not arise, which is amazing in any movie involving Willie Nelson. Where will hemp fit in terms of liquid fuel for motor vehicles?
Well, it's I have a funny story for you about Willie Nelson in connection with this project that I'm working on now, a documentary that I'm myself making. But suffice to say, for the moment, he will be mentioning him very soon. But so I drove for this hemp ebook we're talking about. I drove in a hemp powered limo, powered by an engineer, a fellow named Bill Altos, who's a friend of mine now, and. It was an amazing story. The limo was purportedly once owned by Ferdinand Marcos. It was a 1979 Mercedes. So Bill filled it up with hemp and gives me a ride.
Did you find any of his wife's shoes thrown around the back there?
No.
Imelda Marcos had a shoe fetish. She had like hundreds and hundreds of shoes. Anyway, yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, that joke, he does, in one of our video clips, he does assure me I can put my bags in the trunk and that Amelda's shoes are no longer there. But, it can be done. Here's the deal. As I told you, the Canadian market is geared towards seed oil for food today, for American upper crust food products. And, so all those varieties are really high in the omega-3s and the lignin that you want to eat. It's not, no varieties are as yet grown for oil, in other words, for seed crop as opposed to fiber crop, specifically for fuel. If that happens, could hemp become a major biofuel player? Yes, but keep in mind there are very few diesel vehicles in the passenger fleet in North America. So while I welcome that, I myself drive on vegetable oil in a diesel-powered vehicle today. I would love to fill her up with hemp. The varieties aren't there yet, so it was food-grade oil that we drove in on this limo for researching this book. And so cost is thus still pretty high. And then the other issue is ethanol isn't really online for cellulose yet for the fibers of the plant. I'd love to see that happen, but not ready for prime time yet.
Huh. Well, of course, you know, the video pointed out that the diesel engine, I guess the guy's name was Rudolph Diesel,
yep.
Was invented originally to run on peanut oil.
That's right.
It was not meant to run on gasoline. And so everybody thinks, well, now, you know, what a revolutionary idea, run diesel engines on biofuels. It was originally meant to run on biofuels.
He explicitly made speeches in which he said that he was trying to keep the farmer and his tractor independent from the petroleum tar industry. This was shortly before he drowned under suspicious circumstances in the English Channel.
Yeah, and I'll tell you this, in this film, I wish I remember the name of it, it was narrated by Woody Harrelson. People who were in L.A. were doing conversions to electric cars. Oh, no, this is a different film, sorry. I watched one right after the other. Just prior to the one on biofuels, I watched one on electric cars, and they were doing great, great stuff with old cars, and their shop mysteriously burned down. I wish they'd stop busting Willie Nelson already. He's been arrested for marijuana God knows how many times, but he sure ain't giving it up. I mean, that's cool. Did you meet Willie Nelson in the course of doing this book?
Not yet, but let's see, what can I say?
Well, let me just say, I've met him a number of times. He's like you'd imagine, you'd really want your grandfather, you know, Willie Nelson. He's like this, he must be about 5 feet tall, and he walks around, he's got this ponytail down the back, and he is this the mellowest guy that ever lived. I mean, Willie Nelson is everything you would imagine him to be, and he's done great work on this. He's really pushing biofuels to help the farmers, And, you know, he's totally tuned into the farmers through Farm Aid and all the other stuff he does in Texas there. And I'm sure, given his strong, unyielding advocacy for marijuana, that this will be part of the cannabis will be part of the Willie, bio-Willie mix in a very short period of time.
Yes, that's a safe. That's safe to say.
Okay, so moving right along here, we've you're saying that the primary market for hemp in the United States right now is food, and it's I guess that all comes from the seed. Is that correct?
That's right. Seed
and the
oil.
Seed is very high in protein and in beneficial oil. How does the oil compare in terms of nutrients to flax, olive, and other basic oils?
Great question. So, very well, so flax, I'll tell you a few things I can tell you about hemp and flax. I've been using hemp and flax both, a tablespoon of each in my morning shake every day for years. So they both have really terrific omega profiles. So we have two, most listeners probably know this, we have two omega fatty acids that we humans digest, omega-6 and omega-3. And it's not so much about how much you have, it's about the ratio. And, the simplest way to say it is that both hemp and flax are both really great in that regard. Hemp has some advantages and flax has other advantages. But one of the things I did in this book is went to in a lab, in a university lab, and interviewed the researchers of a paper that had just come out about hemp-fed chickens and how that affects their the omega profile in their eggs. In other words, what you're getting in the egg when the chickens are hemp fed. And basically the conclusion was comparable to a high omega, what today is officially in Canada, at least where I was doing the research, and I'm assuming it's comparable. What in Canada is allowed to be labeled an omega rich. Have you ever seen these eggs that are that call themselves omega rich eggs? Hemp eggs, hemp fed eggs. Give you that.
Wow. Okay. And I assume we want to. Well, you just feed them the seed. Is that what they eat? Or do you grind up the plant to make that into some kind of feed? What? How's it work?
They did two different things because what happens is when you press the seeds and the oil drips out, that's like, you know, liquid gold. That's going into my shake. That's going into Nature Valley honey granola hemp cereal in your food co-op, you know what I mean? That's where that stuff is going. What's left is called the seed cake, and it's very high in protein and still has a good omega profile. That often will go into granola bars, to energy bars, and various kinds of food. So I believe, if I'm remembering correctly, that they fed those chickens both. In different percentages. At some point, it was 20% of their feed, 12% of their feed, and I think they fed them both oil and seed cake, and both had the results you're looking for, health results that you'd want.
Do we have any results from four-leggeds like cattle and hogs and
underway sheep? Underway now by the same department at the same university.
Uh huh. So they're researching it.
They're researching now, yeah.
All right, good. Well, keep us posted on that. That'll be good. Okay, so outside of the food now, we've looked at building material. Well, we didn't talk. I have heard that bamboo can be used in as a building material, and it's actually comparable in strength to steel. Is there anything? How does hemp stand up with bamboo as a building material?
Well, you asked a really good question. If you were going to ask about textiles, I'd be able to jump in and say that you have to
talk about. Let's switch to textiles. I actually bought a pair of hemp pants from Don Worshafter's Ohio Hempery years ago, and they lasted forever. So tell us about the use of hemp in textiles.
One second. The issue with natural fiber textile production, once you're moving away from coal, from cotton, rather, which of course we should be, because of its water and pesticide use, you have to do a lot to most natural fibers, other than silk, to make it have that feel that we could pass what I refer to in this new hemp book as the gap requirement. It has to feel like a nice, soft T-shirt that people expect in the store.
You know what they call that in the clothing industry? They call it the hand, H-A-N-D.
Right, the hand, or the, and cottonization is also what they're trying, is how they refer to it sometimes in the industry, too. That's a problem, a big problem with bamboo, but it's also still an issue with hemp as well. China, far and away, dominates the hemp textile market, as they probably do the bamboo market. I don't know about the agricultural side, whether or not there is, you know, whether or not harvestable bamboo is a sustainable crop, but I can tell you that hemp is.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know much about bamboo, but it's very, very strong, ridiculously powerful. Now, I've also read and seen, and maybe it's in your next book, that you can mix hemp stalks in with concrete and make it stronger. Are you aware of that part at all? Is that real?
Yeah, that's back on that load-bearing side. You know, instead of mixing it with lime as you do for the insulation, if you want it to be a load-bearing material, that's when it can just help reduce the carbon footprint while increasing the performance of traditional load-bearing materials like concrete.
Okay,
the issue,
good. And is anybody actually doing that now, or is it still not legal?
No, everybody's they're doing it all over Europe, Canada, New Zealand, and the research is still going on because what's happening is all the binding agents for industrial materials, and this includes not just building materials, but, you know, we were talking about fiberglass replacements for door paneling and stuff like that. All the binding agents, besides often being comprised of toxic materials, they're designed chemically to bind with synthetic materials. So once you add any natural fiber, especially, let's say, you know, in this case, hemp, into the mix, the chemistry is going to be different because you're talking about binding organic molecules, and so that research is still going on. The good news is it looks as though the resulting sort of next-generation materials, which is a back-to-the-future situation, the binding is going to be less toxic, and that's what the chemistry is going to demand.
Huh. Good. And how does it compare with strength and things like that?
One of the problems in North America is that the farmers aren't yet growing fiber crops for the strong, consistent fibers that are needed in industrial applications. Europe has a bit of a head start on that, and it works great in Europe. I mean, that's why BMW isn't putting it into its paneling just to flash peace signs. It's because it works well and is cost-effective.
Wait, you just ran something by here. So who is it that's putting hemp into what in their automobiles?
BMW, Mercedes, and Dodge, just to name a few. There's more. Lotus, they all use hemp fibers in their door paneling.
As opposed to fiberglass? Or
Yeah.
And where is the hemp grown? Are they growing hemp in Europe?
They are.
Where? Yeah. What countries?
All over. The British company I was telling you about offers guidelines to farmers on what varieties they'd like grown and that they will buy. It's a $100 million annual market, I think, right now in Europe.
Wow. Are there any countries in Europe where it's illegal to grow it?
No, in fact, or if there are, they're minor and, not major players to begin with. But Spain never banned hemp farming. Germany got it going decades ago. Romania is a big leader. And this is all on the industrial fiber side. China is the biggest on textile, and Canada is the biggest on nutrition and seed oil.
Amazing. Okay, we're talking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail. 2 weeks ago, we talked with him about cannabis and we're talking about cannabis too, but then about marijuana and the $6 billion a year industry in the golden, the green triangle, emerald. It's the emerald triangle, right? In Northern California. Today we've been talking about industrial uses of hemp. We haven't had a break, and we're getting closing in on the hour here, so we may go all the way through for the first time. I don't know. if we hear the Solartopia song from Dana Lyon, we'll take a short break. But, Doug, let's jump back to marijuana for a minute. Is there anything new to report in the last 2 weeks in the medical or otherwise marijuana world? How is the legalization doing in Washington and Colorado?
Well, there is something new to report in the Emerald Triangle, in the area that I researched for Too High to Fail, where cannabis has effectively been legalized and permitted in Mendocino County, California. We discussed last week that even though the federal authorities in the form of the U.S. Attorney's Office for Northern California continue, they attacked the program that was reducing crime and raising local tax revenue and saving law enforcement jobs and hurting cartels and mandating sustainable growing techniques by raiding one of the farmers that I followed and then personally threatening with prison the local board of supervisors of the county government that passed the what's called the zip tie ordinance up there.
Well, that would be an astonishing moment if the federal government came in and arrested the local government.
Isn't it astonishing enough that they're threatening to do it? So they shut down the program because that was scary to the local guys. So they and gals, they shut it down. And a year later, the U.S. Attorney's Office then subpoenaed the shutdown program for the personal financial records of the farmers that were brave enough to say, I am not a criminal, I want to pay my taxes, I want to grow sustainably, and I want to support my local government and hurt the cartel. They subpoenaed the financial records from the county, and the county said, no, we will not give you that information. So this has all been developing over the last few months. And what appears to me to be a pretty big victory, the U.S. Attorney's Office is saying, just yesterday, I got an email from one of the Board of Supervisors, remember, and it's, you know, after continuing the hearing where the county's saying, no, we won't give it to you, and the judge has to decide, federal judge has to decide whether or not the county of Mendocino has to give the financial records to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Can they keep offering these continuances for now for months, 4 or 5 months? And just yesterday, it sounds like to me, I've sent up a few emails going, wait, that's a victory, right, for the American people. The U.S. Attorney's Office is like, you know what? Oh, don't worry right now. Right now, don't worry about a continuance or, you know, all this other stuff. We're just not going to think about this right now. Like, and they're not saying it's case closed and it's over, but they're not even bothering to reschedule a hearing, which to me sounds like
yeah,
a win for the county.
Well, maybe they're going to bring in drone strikes, you know. We're talking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail. We're at 888-874-4888. We're about running out of time here. Doug, you really can't fill an hour. What else do you want to tell us about the industrial hemp here that we haven't hit on?
Well, thank you, by the way, for having me on twice. And, yeah, I'd love to do it again.
I'll have you back a third time when your book on hemp comes out. So what have we missed here today?
Let's see. We've talked about energy, industrial. how about putting the small farmers back to work? Farmers, I've been interviewing farmers from North Dakota to Colorado to Kentucky, and they're basically saying, oh my gosh, like a new cash crop that we can grow during climate change, that's a saving grace for a lot of farmers.
Well, let me ask you one question. Now, you know, as a historian, I can tell you that cotton killed the South, or the South killed cotton because they didn't rotate their crops. Does hemp have to be rotated? How many years can you grow hemp on the same piece of land and have the land continue to be healthy?
Ideally, it's part of, and this is what all humans have always done until the 20th century, or late 19th century, which created the Dust Bowl. Ideally, of course, you're using it wisely and rotating it in different areas. So if you have, let's say, a slightly hilly, less well-drained portion of 5,000 acres in North Dakota, let's say, that's 3,000 acres that aren't as rich. Grow hemp there for a couple of years to improve the soil, and just when it's starting to, you're profiting from that hemp crop the whole time, and just when you're starting to have a little bit of yield declining on those prime 2,000 lower acres from growing whatever it is, canola oil, wheat, corn for those 2 or 3 years, ship the hemp there for a couple of years and do something else on the hilly areas. So, yeah, it's part of common sense agricultural rotation that's been, you know, that humans have known how to do for 3-4 millennia.
Interesting. So just for the interest of those of you who went and saw the movie Lincoln, the real issue in the Civil War was not, to begin with, the existence of slavery in the South. It was really whether or not slavery was going to expand to Kansas, Nebraska, and the states in the West. And the Civil War really broke out in Kansas when John Brown and went to war with the slave owners out there. The idea that slavery was ever going to work in Kansas was ridiculous. I guess they thought they were going to grow cotton out of there. They're going to use slaves to grow corn, but that had no real basis in reality. And what killed cotton in the South, as I mentioned, was they grew it on the same land year after year after year. These slave owners were really stupid, and hopefully they won't be doing that with hemp. Does hemp grow better in hot climates and cold? How does it do in terms of where you need to grow it?
There are so many varieties that you can find one that's been traditionally grown just about everywhere. In Hawaii, they're finding Chinese varieties work well. In Canada, they converted this Finnish variety to be their ideal oil crop with government-supported field testing. So there's basically, except for Antarctica and Washington, D.C., there's no places too chilly to grow it.
Washington D.C. will grow just fine. I can see potted plants in the Senate office buildings of hemp as we speak. We've been talking with Doug Fine, author of Too High to Fail, maybe you ought to have a kind of a write-in contest for a title for your new book. I think you should have hemp in the title somewhere, but
right now the working title is bear with me. It's King Seed: Industrial Cannabis's First Killer Apps in the Digital Age, a playbook for the patriotic hemp farmer, entrepreneur, and investor who wants to help humanity transition smoothly from fossil fuels, tree farms, and monoculture.
That's not all your title. it sounds good to me. So are you going to have growing tips in there and stuff like that?
Yeah, totally. One of the notes, in between first and final draft right now, one of the notes in the memo that came from the editors was, this really isn't a handbook for farmers, because there's areas where I do get into that a little bit, so I might be toning it down, but it'll be in there, including video interviews with Canadian hemp farmers that I met with on their farm.
Excellent. So now, what is the report from Colorado and Washington? Have there been drug-crazed, gang assaults and people enduring reefer madness here among the legality of this demon weed here, or what?
Because I've been so involved in this industrial cannabis book, I haven't been paying as close attention to it in recent weeks as I had been prior, but I will say that the initial task force reports in Colorado, it seems to me like Washington seems to be doing a really good progressive job, and they're working on it and want it to work. And in Colorado, there's some question about that, because the task force on it, let's put it this way, I've heard grumblings, and there's always going to be grumblings, but there's one thing that outrages me as a sustainability journalist and someone who wants a climate to be breathable for my children's children, and that is that the Colorado Task Force recommended a ban on outdoor cultivation, only indoor cultivation. Now imagine that. Imagine if you were not allowed to eat farmer's market broccoli anymore, but only hothouse-grown, mega corporations broccoli or corn or carrots, you'd be outraged. At least you are, if you eat the way I do, you'd be outraged.
Yeah, it's totally insane. I saw that too. It's ridiculous. I did see a video, and I can't remember which state it was from. I think it was from Washington, where it was really a reality warp, because the police were testing three people's driving abilities on marijuana. And they were the cops were just walking around with these bags of pot, rolling up joints and watching these three test drivers smoke marijuana. I thought it was wonderful. Hey, Doug Fine, thank you so much. I hear about Pete Seeger in the background there. This is the first show we've done without a break. You are a terrific guest. Let me know when your next book on hemp comes out, and we will talk ourselves silly. This has been Doug Fine with Too High to Fail on the Solartopia Green Power Wellness Show. We will be back next week to talk about Fukushima. Thank you so much, Doug.
Thanks, Harvey.
Solartopia, all over the toxic world.
Will we beat the earth?